1909 North Hayden Island Drive in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome, dear listeners. You are here with us on Preference Radio on KBOO. I'm your host, Alan. This is our Queer Boo Hour, different queer or trans programming, 6 o'clock every Tuesday of the week. And it's a five Tuesdays this month, so you hear a little extra of my voice. So thanks for joining us. We have author Achi Obejas on the line with us. Achi, can you hear?
I do. Hi, how are you?
I have a cold, so I was listening to my voice on tape earlier today, and I was not thrilled.
Oh, well, it sounds, vaguely sexy, so it's good.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I've been up at Orcas Island for the past week, so I've been sort of an idyllic place, it's been really sweet.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I have this memory from a long time ago, 15 years, I think.
Wow.
That you were living in Portland then? Is that?
Oh, no, I've never lived in Portland.
That's funny. I was reading, we came all the way from Cuba during a breakup. It was a book that cheered me at a time when I needed it. I had carved out a tiny space in a breakup house, threw some blankets and pillows together. That was one of the books I read, and somehow I got the idea and I have remembered all this time falsely.
this happens, I hear.
Do you want to introduce yourself to everyone?
I'm sorry?
Do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Oh, sure. My name is Achi Obejas, and I am a writer with a number of books out. My most recent book is called The Tower of Antilles, and it's a collection of stories.
Oh, wonderful. And you've done translations?
Yes, I've done a lot of translations for folks like Juno Diaz and Rita Indiana and Wendy Guerra. I started to do a lot of commercial fiction for Amazon, which is fun, but weird, interesting.
And you've edited anthologies, right? I think.
Yes, I've done two anthologies. I did one called Havana Noir, which is part of the Akashic Books Noir series, which is a tremendous experience. The stories are really, really, really dark. I think it's probably darker than the average Akashic Noir anthology. And then the other anthology I did with my wife, I did with Megan Bales. It's called Immigrant Voices, 21st Century Stories. And they're all stories about immigration in the 21st century, because it's changed so much from the 20th. And that one we did with the Great Books Foundation. So it's a book that gets used a lot in book clubs and universities and stuff. Anyway, that was also a lot of fun. But it was a very different experience, dealing with very different kinds of materials, et cetera. I'm working on another anthology now. It's based on this crazy idea. I don't know if you're familiar with the Hemingway story, Indian Camp. It's one of his early stories. It's from the 20s, and it's a story in which, in very typical Hemingway fashion, you know, everything is compacted and compressed into like 4 or 5 pages. But the only speakers in that story are 3 white males. And yet the story has like 11 characters, and they're all indigenous. So the story is told strictly from the point of view of this little kid who comes with his dad to the Indian camp. Anyway, the idea is to use all the other characters to retell the story, and, you know, sort of an Alexandria Quartet kind of approach to the thing. See what happens with the story, see what the actual story is when everybody gets to tell their version of it. Anyway, I've got some great folks who've contributed to that anthology. I'm just putting that together now, but it's really been the most compelling and the sort of the most intense experience, because it's really writing. These folks are writing on demand, so to speak. You know, they're being commissioned to write. This isn't just, hey, do you happen to have a story that's, about immigration hanging around? This is a very different sort of thing. So I'm very pleased. I mean, I've had some great contributors. Porshi Sekekpor is one of them. Bayo Jikuchu is another. It's a wonderful indigenous writer from Oakland, very young, named Tommy Orange. Some really, really great stuff.
You mentioned that immigration has changed. Let's talk about that. I've heard you discuss this a bit in other conversations, in particular about how global culture, I think, helps people orient themselves to some degree across borders.
I'm sorry, global culture? Is that what you said?
American culture, globalizing. Helps folks orient themselves, helps folks have a basis for conversation.
Me personally, I feel like we should all be reading, well beyond our areas of knowledge. I feel like, as a general rule, especially in the United States, we default very much to what we know. Like, I know that when I was living in Chicago, there was always an obsession with Chicago writers and, always, wanting to read each other. And I think that's great and very supportive. But, sometimes it felt very narrowing. Not that there weren't many, 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 many Chicago writers, but that I always felt like we should be reading, North Korean writers, and we should be reading South African writers, and we should be reading, writers from Germany, so that we could get a kind of a greater sense of each other and have more of a connection, I guess, to people who are not like us, to sort of use those muscles and be forced to consider that things are different in other places, maybe just a little bit different, maybe very, very different, but that we can still empathize and recognize and get, offended by and enraged by and hurt by, things in other places as much as, in areas that are more familiar to us. I think we're destabilized a little bit when we're experiencing stories from places that we're not familiar with. And for me as a reader, that's actually a good thing. I like sort of being in a place where I'm sort of completely surrendered to this other reality, and I think most readers, eventually, even though maybe a little wheezy at first when they get into that destabilizing mode, I think they usually end up liking that a lot more and being, I think, more satisfied, more intrigued and compelled by the stories.
I think there's a limited number of books. I mean, obviously, there's a limited number of books that are translated into English. So it's as though non-American fiction is pre-curated for us. And I wonder how much you think translation is for the audience, the intended audience in this new language that a book becomes? Is it meant to be?
Well, yeah, no, I think I get your question. In the United States, only about 3-4% of the books that are published are actually translations, which is way under everybody else in the developed world that has any kind of publishing industry. Part of it is that, of course, the United States is a highly educated population that, is producing its own literature, and there are only so many books you can publish. But it's also because there's not a lot of looking beyond our own borders, as a general rule. So I think translators have to sort of look at every project, very specifically and in a very focused and individualized way in terms of how they come at it. I mean, is it for the audience? I mean, I think, yes, of course, translation is for the audience. Do translators occasionally engage in ways that, has to do with their own particular styles or their own particular signatures in terms of the work and the language that they use? Of course. But I don't think translators, as a general rule, make such dramatic changes in work that it isn't ultimately about the audience. I mean, I think even when they do make dramatic changes, it's usually very much about the audience. There's a lot of controversy right now in the translation world over a book called The Vegetarian, which is from South Korea. Mm-hmm. And I believe the author's name is Han Kim, but her translator is a young woman, a young British woman, white woman, named Deborah Smith. And Deborah translated The Vegetarian in a way that really caused a big scandal in South Korea, because she worked hand in hand with the author. So this was not anything that was done behind the author's back, but she inserted a lot of adverbs and she really, and adjectives and descriptors and things like this into the text. And almost every other page is altered from the original, because she felt like that the way that South Korean literature evolves is very elliptical, that you have to read between the lines a lot, but that Americans aren't used to reading like that, and that the passivity of the narrators in South Korean literature is kind of off-putting to Americans. So she shifted it in order to engage the American reader more. I mean, a lot of people have said, well, this isn't really a translation. This is more like a reinterpretation, a revision, a rewriting, that's ultimately what all translation is anyway. So it's just been really interesting to sort of see the responses to her work, which, by the way, has critically been just a big rave. She and the author won the Man Booker Prize last year together, which is a very rare thing for the translator to be included in honors like that.
Well, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. I just was sort of, I think, one last question on this. The process of curation, quickly, what does that look like? How is it that we do get to see the books we see? There's two cases at our downtown library, which are librarians' choices, and most of it is world literature and translation. And I always wonder, why these books? What do I not know? How does that happen?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I think, a lot of it is luck. Some of it has to do with the editor's taste. I always sort of think about Cuban and, Cuban literature when I think of this. There was a little rash of Cuban writers who got published a few years ago. And, what was that process? Why those guys and not other guys? Well, a lot of it had to do with the fact that these editors, American editors, came to Cuba, and they came to Havana, and they met Havana writers. They didn't meet anybody from the interior. They didn't meet anybody from the provinces, from the far reaches of the island. So those people didn't get picked up. You know, the people who got picked up were the more urban writers, were the ones who were accessible, mm-hmm. for the most part, usually people who could communicate in English in some way. I mean, of course, this is not the way it happens everywhere, but this is a country that's been blockaded and it's been, you know, inaccessible in a lot of ways, especially intellectually, to Americans for a long time. And there was something very random about the way that people ended up getting published. And it had to do with, you know, these sort of crazy ways of making the text accessible. You know, when I did Havana Noir, I published, I think it was 13 people who lived on the island. And at least four or five of those, it was their first publication in English, and maybe more. And it, I can tell you that some of those probably would have never gotten published under other circumstances, because they happened to be people who I met in workshops or at cafes or whatever, and then, you know, or through other friends. It's not like Akashic knew who they were. So I think it kind of makes the argument for moving around and, you know, shaking hands and playing a little bit of that game if you're not in the U.S. and you want to be published in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a formula. I don't think there's a particular way about it. I mean, some editors might be looking very much at, you know, works that are accessible. That's what they want. They're looking for stuff that they really believe the American reader will like. And then there are editors who look for what they think American readers should read, regardless of its difficulty in terms of, you know, getting inside it culturally or politically. So I think it's actually quite randomly. I wish there were a broader and more sort of established way of doing these things, but in a way, the fact that it's so random and so spontaneous also means that you get surprises. You get, you get people that, you know, maybe aren't even all that well known in their particular countries, but who resonate, you know, in English nonetheless.
You are here on Thursday for a reading with Robert Arellano.
Yes, yes.
At Powell's on Hawthorne.
Yeah, with Bobby Arellano. And, this is like the 29th reading we've done together in the past 10 years. Oh. So it's always fun. He's great.
Well, you're coming to talk about, at the very least, your new book, The Tower of the... Yeah.
Yeah, The Tower of the Antilles is a collection of stories. They're all in some way, some directly, some indirectly, connected to Cuba. I think almost all of them have some sort of queer angle to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I think the two big sort of queer stories in the book are one called Kimberly,
mm-hmm.
which is a story about, it's a very dark story,
mm-hmm.
About a young woman who takes in a friend who's actually almost an acquaintance during a time when there's a serial killer on the loose in Bloomington, Indiana. And the friend is very heartbroken and sort of homeless and not very much herself. And they get involved in a very peculiar way. It's one of the better stories in the book. And the other one is a story called Superman, which is actually based on a real person, a sex worker in Havana who had a career that lasted from the 30s to the 50s at a place called the Shanghai Theater. The theater was a notorious sex theater. They would show porn movies, but they also had live sex shows. The shows were really incredible. They had, you know, a court, and to be just this phenomenal, you know, personality on stage, So I ended up doing a lot of research about him, but then ended up sort of imagining a lot about what his life was like. He was also rumored to be gay. So what the story does is speculate about all the possibilities of who he was and who he might have been, how his life might have turned out. He disappeared when the revolution came in. He just vanished from sight. There's literally no official end to his story.
Kimberly attracted me very much as a story. I think that in my life I've both served in a Kimberly role in other people's lives, and also been the person who took Kimberly in. And there certainly was a foreboding something was going to happen.
Yeah. I think we all have somebody in our past like that, right? Somebody that we are very attracted to, precisely because they're kind of dangerous. Mm-hmm. They seem to like danger seems to follow them around in a way. Like they're sort of cursed, and we fall for them anyway.
Yeah,
I love that story. And it's a funny story to me because I wrote that story in Spanish, and then I ended up having to translate it. And I wrote it in Spanish, but I wrote it in Havana, and my brain was on Spanish. So it was peculiar to be sitting in Havana in a sweltering summer writing a story about the Midwest, because that story is also very Midwestern.
Mm-hmm. There's a concept I carry with me that I learned in high school. It's called a millionaire squid, and it's that person who attaches themselves to you, and they're chaotic, and there's nothing that you can do about that in any way, and you really have to you really just have to accept it, you know. You can't control this person's behavior. You can't put limits on them. They might leave for a while and then show up again. And, you know, there's, you know, everybody's maybe not always, but often has a millionaire squid that's, you know, that's...
I think that's very much what happened to this this narrator with Kimberly. Kimberly sort of attached herself to her, and that was... It brought with her, you know, all the things that were imperiling her, you know, and they are not always outside forces. I mean, there's this chaos, but Kimberly and people like her sort of trail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
All right, Achi, we're going to take a little break here and listen to an interview about pinkwashing and some events that are happening in Portland. Your book is The Tower of the Antilles, short stories. You'll be here on Thursday evening. Very exciting.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being on.
Sure. Thank you so much. Take care.
Do you ever miss back home?
Prepare for takeoff, touchdown, Ben Gurion. Strict search, make sure nobody enter with bombs. Blue, white flag for this birthright, Torah Mon. Never mention three villages that the airport is on. Recent history buried, but it speaks to the sand. All Jews, law of return, I don't seem to understand. A land without a people, for people without a land. But I see a man standing with a key and a deed in his hand. Museum of the Holocaust, walking outside in the distance, all ghosts throwing a Molotov. Houses burned with kerosene, mass graves, couldn't bear the scene. It wasn't a pogrom, it was the ruins of Deir Yassin. Shopping at the Kenyon Malha, built it on the back of the town Al Malha. Wishing we could call its name, appalled by the change. And now a marvel of chains is all that remains. My evil misses people, not places. Have you seen the town from names of Arabic to Hebrew?
It's a good one, you only give my strap long. a hole in the bricks. I'm feeling more than melancholy. This used to be the Moroccan quarter until we stopped them short. And now they grandkids is the ones that storm rocks of borders. I ain't wanna play and I don't pray often, so I'm A-walling. While you making native sons feel like a stranger in their homeland, like James Baldwin. This ain't about a Quran or a synagogue or mosque or Torah. Colonizers break it into acres and dunhams, erasing the culture when they change hyper to hyper. Change out for the Yafo, the old city left to haunt. Homeless pronounced hummus, we ate in the restaurant. Next hit the discotheque, yes we on a list of guests. Palestinians can't get in, it's blatant disrespect. Cops stopping for speaking their languages, it's dangerous to repeat it when we're history, we disconnect. My Imam misses people, not places. Actually seen the towns with names of Arabic to Hebrew places. The policies is evil and racist. Uprooted the grove to build a wall, not a future enclosed. Settlement spreading like cancer and toxic sewage polluted the roads. Not full of checkpoints that superimpose the truth and it shows. Village ruins overgrown with planted trees. Who'd have thought the desert blooms in two-inch spot? I can't believe it ain't environmental. Disguising lies of sick and lives like manatees. Calling it a transfer, please. More like a catastrophe. Birthright choice recruiting them, confuse them into moving in. Claim it's only names and words, but denying the root of them. Power been abusing it, our past never excusing them. 60 since 48 and 40 since Jerusalem. My boy Shaddy wanted to visit us so badly. He lied he's diabetic to see it for 5 seconds. 194 ruled the courts in the case. Mom, you can't disconnect the people from the importance of place. My Imam misses people, not places. Has she seen the towns with names in Arabic, the Hebrew places? The policies is evil and racist, deceitful and heinous. You'll never be a peaceful state with legal displacement.
Welcome back. This is Preference here on KBOO. I'm your host, Alan. That was People Not Places by Detroit artist Invincible. Just to read a little quote on Invincible's idea in the song. Quote, the song takes the listener on a journey through a haunted birthright tour where the buried Palestinian significance of each location comes to light. Along the route, I expose the process of historic and continued colonization as being even deeper than land seizure and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, but one that is invested in erasing the Arabic language, culture, and memory. We're going to hear now a pre-recorded interview that I did the other day with Jonathan Irwin. He's a local activist for peace and solidarity with Palestinians. Welcome, Jonathan, and thanks for joining us here in Preference.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Alan. Again, my name's Jonathan. I pronounce they. I'm a queer Jewish American born in Portland, Oregon. I came here today to talk about my experiences around queer Jewish identity and its intersection with opposition to the occupation of Palestine by what is known as the State of Israel. I guess I can just tell a little bit about my backstory. Like a lot of people in this country, I was raised like kind of Reformed Jewish, in a progressive, except for Palestine, as it's sometimes known, kind of political affiliation. I kind of came more into my political self-awareness and queer identity in my 20s. And over a number of years, kind of felt challenged to kind of reconsider what I had learned and come to think about the State of Israel and its behavior towards the Palestinian people and globally, and a lot of other myths accompanying that. And kind of along the way, I ended up deciding that I needed to both get involved in Palestine solidarity activity locally and then eventually took advantage of what's often called like birthright, so-called birthright trip or taglit trip, as it's called by Israelis, to go spend time in Palestine and then go volunteer with International Solidarity Movement, which is a an all-volunteer international solidarity movement with Palestinian civil society, which has been around for, like, at this point, I think about 15 years or 16 years. And so, yeah, I went and did that and was there for about 3 months and had to endure 10 days of brainwashing and then 2.5 months of secondary trauma with people living under occupation, and came back with a stronger sense of Jewish identity. And I left, but one built around solidarity with oppressed peoples. So that kind of brings me to kind of what I think you invited me to here to talk about in part, which was the concept of pinkwashing, which is one of many tools that the Israeli state utilizes to kind of validate and whitewash, but for queer people, the occupation of Palestinian people on their indigenous land, since depending on which lens you're looking at, either the turn of the 20th century when the early Zionists started to move to Palestine, 1948 when Israel conquered and was given access to about half of the land of ancestral Palestine, and then 67 when they took the rest of it and have been chipping away at it ever since. And so pinkwashing basically relies on this idea that that the Middle East is somehow filled with people who hate queer people, and that really Israel is the one country where queer people can feel safe. And they oftentimes will like to present images of both European Jews living in that land who are queers, you know, being safe, and then sometimes also Palestinian queers being safe there. And there's a lot we could dig into there. I guess I'm curious if you, is there anything that you wanted to, that you want us to talk about next and under that? Or?
Well, I just finished rereading Sarah Shulman's book, Israel, Palestine, and the Queer International. And one of the things she really tries to identify is what solidarity with Palestinian queers consists of, or could mm-hmm. consist of.
Right. And I think that was a question I kind of oftentimes struggled with when I was in Palestine, because there are certainly people who are Palestinian who are homophobic, and I didn't see it as my role to, especially when I was there for a very short time, not enough time to really build relationships to like change that. And then there were other people who were Palestinian who knew I was queer, and that wasn't an issue, and there were Palestinian queers I hung out with. One thing that really stands out to me actually is some of the experiences of a friend of mine who I made when I was in Palestine, who worked with a group called Anarchists Against the Wall, which is a predominantly Israeli kind of solidarity group. And he's, like many members of their group, is queer, and in his case, Mizrahi, or like a Middle Eastern Jew. And he talked about some of the relationships that he developed working on the ground with people, and where, you know, whereas maybe early on people might be a little bit confused or uncertain about what his identity looked like, after, you know, he'd been going and working with people for years, you know, going to the same protests week after week, many Palestinian civil society groups protest weekly on their like holy day, starting on like Friday afternoon. And yeah, people would ask him like, you know, what is, you know, how's your boyfriend doing, things like that. And it was like, it's like a form of solidarity that works about like mutual sharing and growing and learning from each other. I think that those are some really good questions that sounds like Sarah Shulman posed, and I'm curious if there were any like solutions that you feel like you got out of reading that book, or if any things that you've heard about that kind of added to your understanding of what solidarity looked like from both from a maybe from a more distant, you know, level, because I can't go to the protests right now in Palestine. They might not let me into the within the boundaries of 67 or 48 bounds mm-hmm. of the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm. Well, what Shulman ends up doing is of course traveling to the Middle East and talking with people and learning about their lives and their activism and their needs and their desires from them. Not letting this Israeli propaganda campaign stand in for people's actual experience and their actual desires.
Right. That's so revolutionary, actually, listening to, like, frontline communities talking about their own experiences and what they need. I think the thing that I probably most heard was just, like, people's desire just to be able to live their lives and, like, have access to their olive groves and be able to exist and have connection with their ancestors and leave their children something. And I think, like many people who've spent time with people experiencing active land theft, theft of livelihood, theft of freedom, theft of life and health and wellness, such as people living under occupation, I felt like I walked left with a lot more than I was able to offer. And so, like, part of, for me, my form of solidarity is as much as possible trying to share stories, which is a really intriguing and, like, basic ask that comes out of ISM and out of many, from most Palestinians I built relationships with. It's just like, you know, you can't stay here forever and do this, like, do what you can to share stories. And I think that that's a really great, I think, maybe way to move us into talking about, like, what it looks like to act in solidarity here. And I think that for me, one way I can do that is use the communities I'm part of and try to, like, bring those stories to those communities. So in a similar way, actually, as, like, on some level, as A Wider Bridge tries to kind of utilize this narrative that as Jews and as queer people, we should ally ourselves with a settler colonialist state with one of the largest militaries that's actively erasing a people from their ancestral lands. I think we can also use our experiences as queer people or as Jews or as the intersection of those identities to try to bring those stories to those communities. So, like, I guess kind of along those lines, I can say that for me, like, as a Jewish person whose, you know, family either escaped genocide or died during genocide, like, I didn't survive, my ancestors didn't survive, so that we could, like, ethnically cleanse or remove another people. And I think that as a queer person, like, we don't, like, survive alone, right? We're not in a vacuum, we need all of us. And I think that we really have to look at things from kind of an intersectional perspective, a concept that came from, like, a really remarkable, well, both from, like, many generations of Black women, as well as from Kimberly Crenshaw specifically, that we have to kind of look at all of our identities and how those intersect. So, like, occupation is a queer issue because there are queer people living under occupation, just as homelessness is a queer issue because there are many, many queer people who are homeless or who are experiencing homelessness.
A Wider Bridge.
Yeah, let's go back there.
Yeah.
So they're a group that is present. They've been doing some organizing. I think they were formed in 2010 in 1948. Which is sometimes what, and actually in Jerusalem Rhodes, and is also, and was kind of like pushed as a movement in the United States as a way of supporting their, supporting that project. And they're bringing a speaker to come and speak this Wednesday, Neve Shalom, to try to encourage, the Jewish queer community here, which is certainly growing as numbers of Jews and queers, like, continue to grow in Portland, to ally themselves with that. What else do you want to know about it?
What do we know about this event? What are they aiming for?
Well, I don't know specifically if you go to their website and if you go to their Facebook event, they basically are just trying to build support. What that looks like would most likely mirror a lot of the pushes for support for the state of Israel in communities across the U.S. There's a lot of the kind of the front lines of the culture war in the United States is around the subject of boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which has put a lot of pressure on the Israeli state by way of its economic issues. So, like, boycotting Israeli products, divesting from Israeli institutions, and sanctioning authors and other like cultural creators who uphold and support the occupation. And so there's been a lot of fighting on oftentimes college campuses. The U.S. government has tried, as well as Oregon, and many other states have all taken positions on trying to outlaw support for advocating BDS. And so kind of what a lot of the advocates of these groups will do is they'll show up at other events or in various communities and try to basically add people to the ranks of people who think that the Israeli state is just the best, and or at least no worse than, you know, any other, and basically try to deflate that movement, which has been ultimately pretty successful, including in Portland, through some efforts of groups like Occupation Free Portland and Jewish Voice for Peace, which have put pressure on city council to divest from like Caterpillar and like Wells Fargo and other groups that are invested in the occupation. So that would be my guess as to why they were picking Portland, along with it being, you know, seen as like a queer mecca around Portland, around the U.S.
BDS, I think we can almost measure BDS's success, not perhaps on Israel's economic situation. That's a lot harder to dig into.
There's so many fluctuations. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah.
But the Israeli government continues to pour money into the anti-BDS campaign.
Right.
Including this pink washing campaign, which sort of spreads throughout queer arts and culture organizations and events throughout North America.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's been a lot of organizations and major politicians on the so-called left and so-called right, the so-called right is pretty right, but naming BDS as like number one humanitarian issue and this and that and the other. I think that one thing that can be really useful for us is to debunk some of the ideology behind every time that they bring up their messaging. So with A Wider Bridge, like we said, that they have this idea that Palestinians are and Muslims and Arabic-speaking peoples are somehow more homophobic than Christians or Jews or secular people, and that's just simply not true. It's like kind of mirrors a lot of the ideas of that like Black communities are more homophobic and like numbers don't bear out and like the laws don't bear out. You know, although there are beaches in Tel Aviv where you can walk holding your partner's hand, the Israeli state consistently does not show up for queer people. They kind of rather lean on queer people in a similar way as Donald Trump leaned on queer people or kind of Republican queers in the last election, where he'll like name drop like, oh yeah, you know, you need me to protect you from Islamic terrorism, but then allows like Mike Pence's policies to run roughshod over us. And in the Israeli state, they consistently fail to pass any non-discrimination policies or to respond meaningfully when there was a like right-wing Jewish mass stabbing attack at the 2015 like Gay Pride in Jerusalem. So I think that we can like see that that's built on a lie. And as I was saying about my friend's experiences in Navi Saleh, which is actually the home of actually a Palestinian prisoner right now, Taibbi, big pardon, like his queerness was not a problem. It was more like much more likely to be as being Israeli was a problem, except like they were able to build solidarity by consistency and showing up for people. And then like the idea that like occupation is a queer issue because queer people are occupied is like another reason I think that we can like a way we can debunk their positions.
You're listening to KBOO. This is Preference. We're talking with Jonathan Irwin about queer solidarity with Palestinians.
Where would you like to go next?
Let's take a look at what's happening in Portland that folks might want to participate in. There's a women's march for Palestine on Saturday, I believe at PSU. And then we've got another event coming up in February.
Right. There's a film being shown called Pinkwashing Exposed. It's about a Seattle area anti-pinkwashing campaign from, you know, queers acting in solidarity with Palestinian civil society. And that'll be at Fifth Avenue Cinema at PSU, which on February 8th at 7 p.m. That's at 510 Southwest Hall Street. And that's another great film just for kind of encapsulating a lot of the themes that we're talking about here, as well as like getting to see some of the faces of the occupation and of people resisting it from like a number of different identities.
And I believe how pressure from pro-Israel, I almost want to say forces, that's not quite what I mean, but what that kind of pressure, how it plays out at a very local level. That's a big aspect of that film.
Right, absolutely. Like, and I think you and I were talking about briefly that, like, Portland has a sister city relationship with Ashkelon, which is a settlement community in occupied Palestine, and just as we're trying to tell this story of, like, the Palestinian people, like, emphasizing this idea that all of the, like, stolen land that makes up what is called Israel is somehow, like, a safe haven for queer people, like, helps to paint this picture that kind of muddies the water when increasingly people around the North America, the United States, and the world are showing up and being like, look, this is actually not a good place, this country, and this military doesn't deserve our support. I think that it's also really important for people to kind of see two domains of activism around this for people in our home communities. And one would be just through our personal relationships and friends and family are big, oftentimes one of the most impactful ways that we can kind of change the script. Like I said, I grew up in a family and in a community and a context where support for the state of Israel was assumed. And it can be really hard for people to challenge that in their personal relationships, but I think it's important, just like it's important for those of us who experience whiteness to discuss like white supremacy among our families and friends. I think it's also really important for us to talk about the effects of occupation. And then I think the other domain would be, where possible, finding either community groups or organizations to participate in, or protests and rallies to show up at. It can be kind of hard to see kind of the direct effects of that. And those are ultimately really hard to measure, I think, a lot of the time. But if nothing else, it shows our like Palestinian community members that like people care about them, even while they're living in diaspora. And it helps to kind of shift that narrative. And then it also helps to challenge this, like, whether it's pinkwashing or greenwashing of the occupation or whatever kind of strategy that the, as you said, anti-BDS forces tries to levy to challenge where BDS has been successful and where the culture war against occupation is winning. Because ultimately, it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. Like, queer liberation is bound up with Palestinian liberation, is bound up with liberation of oppressed and occupied peoples everywhere. I think that that in Portland, we have resources like, said, like Occupation Free Portland, or Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, or Jewish Voice for Peace. And then there's many other groups that are doing similar and related work. And, you know, some, I don't identify as a socialist, but many of my socialist friends, like, say, you know, join an organization, and I think that has some wisdom to it. You could also potentially show up on Wednesday and bring up some uncomfortable questions for the organizers of that event about, you know, what about the Palestinian queers whose families are put under economic pressure and can't return home because they've been displaced two generations back, or can't survive because their olive trees were burnt and then their grapes were burnt and then their every other crop was burnt, and who've been put in jail on indefinite detention for 10, 20 years. Like, those are also the stories of queer people, and those need to be heard when we're talking about taking a vacation on a sunny beach.
With pinkwashing, I suppose we're looking at Seattle. Before we came on the air, Jonathan, you mentioned the Chicago Dyke March.
Yeah. So that was, I think, a really interesting event, and the conversation around it I found really fascinating. For background, if you weren't familiar, this year's Dyke March in Chicago took an explicitly anti-imperialist and anti-Zionist position. I usually personally don't use the language of Zionism because it can be coded in many different ways to be anti-Jewish or to be against the occupation or to be against the presence of Jews in Palestine, which is not actually the BDS call or any other call from Palestinian civil society. But under that lens, they ended up taking issue with some marchers who were carrying a rainbow flag with a blue Star of David on it. That flag looked very much like the Israeli flag. And those marchers were asked to put it away or to leave the march. It just so happened those marchers were members of a wider bridge, and that they had previous to the march asked if they would be kicked out for waving one of those flags. And so when they were kicked out by Jewish queers, there ended up being kind of an internet bonanza, and people from a wide variety of political ideologies came down very hard on one way or another. I personally could see a couple of arguments. I'm like, well, yeah, I want for queers who are Jewish to be able to like represent their identities in a visible way. And although I don't personally resonate with the Magen David or Star of David, that doesn't mean that Jews can't. But that at the same time did seem like a very particularly an intentional strategy to like create division. That was wielded by a wider bridge, and that was pretty strategic on their part, I think. So, I don't know, I'm always interested to hear other people's position, but I felt like in that situation, that was a good example of how we need to be ready to have intentional conversations when groups that are, you know, well-financed and have a lot of, and have a strong strategic plan, like, try to create wedges within communities where people are trying to bring people together. And I really applaud the organizers of the Dyke March for taking that position and for following through, even if in the end it ended up playing into the kind of media plan that folks from a wider bridge were trying to play. I can also see people making a different call on a different occasion, so I don't have to take a personal position on whether it was right or wrong, but I think that they were heading in a good direction. And I think that it's really important, and I support other queer and other communities like taking similar positions of saying, you know, if we allow people to take explicitly pro-occupation positions, we are excluding other people, and we need to not do that because, again, our liberation is bound up together.
And there are a lot of lot of lives at stake.
Yeah. There's been a number of shooting deaths this just recently since Donald Trump made his announcement about the placement of the ostensible moving of the capital of what is called Israel to Jerusalem or Uds. And of course, many other deaths besides that that are maybe not as visible, but...
Let's speak to that for a moment. Yeah. The narrative is that Donald Trump is moving the Capitol, but that's not really true.
Clearly not. but by moving kind of our diplomatic representation to a city which historically most countries have refused to place any kind of diplomatic functions in, it's ostensibly giving credence to this idea that that Jerusalem should be under the sole control of the Israeli state, whereas it is even under like kind of the declaration that was given to ostensibly split the land between Palestine and Israel, that was never kind of the plan. It could be shared. It could be, you know, different kinds of plots, but. The idea that it would be under the sole control or the capital of the Israeli state was not. There's also the element that increasingly people who kind of follow the geopolitics of that land from a kind of higher level, which is not principally mine. I usually think about it from like the level of like the people I was spending time with, which is like, we need to survive, like, and our people deserve land. And in some cases, people cared about the geopolitics. But like the people who I followed usually said that like the two-state solution idea is dead because the Israeli state is very intentionally, through its policies of supporting settlement activity, and the United States through its policies of either supporting settlement activity or complete noncommittal around settlements, has basically made that impossible because the Israeli civil society will never back out of, you know, letting go of that land, and the military won't. Let them either. I get pretty hopeless about the cause of Palestinian liberation, or I would, except that Palestinians themselves are so, the people I've spent time with are so confident that you know, they will outlive the occupation, and that the people, the Israelis who are not Mizrahi, who are not from that land, will at some point leave. And since it's their land and their experience, I have to believe them and show up as much as I can in support.
Do you have last thoughts for our listeners, Jonathan?
I have to think about that for a moment.
I'll just, while we take a moment, while Jonathan takes a moment, I'll remind folks that Wednesday is a Wider Bridges event. Saturday is the Women's March for Palestine at Portland State. And in February 8th, Pink Washing Exposed at Fifth Avenue Cinema downtown.
I guess I would just thank you for that reminder of all those events. I guess I would just encourage people to think meaningfully about ways that they can interact with this and every other anti-colonial or like liberation movement, whether that's like learning about companies that are invested in the occupation, like Sabra Hummus or Caterpillar or Motorola, or coming to protests, or showing up for like Filipino solidarity events. Think about ways, especially in the internet age, how we're all connected and how we can all really try to live by that vision of solidarity, whether it's from like a secular perspective or a Jewish perspective or a queer perspective. And yeah, thanks for inviting me on today.
Thanks so much, Jonathan.
All right, the time is 6:58, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up next is Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Hi, I'm Shaheed Hamid, KBOO board member. As we embark upon a new year, the World Arts Foundation and KBOO want to continue to honor the life and legacy of the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. On Monday, January the 15th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., the World Arts Foundation presents its 33rd consecutive tribute to this great American hero and advocate for peace, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Monday, January the 15th, at the Highland Christian Center. Speakers, African drumming, and a variety of musical performances, also broadcast live here on KBOO Radio. A tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Where do we go from here? As people, as family, as community. Monday, January 15th, at 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Highland Christian Center, 7600 Northeast Gleason. Keep alive the dream.
Check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, news, views, and hip-hop.
This is Sister Soulja on Hard Knock Radio. Listen closely.
¿Qué pasa, raza? This is Deuce Eclipse, the Oi Joaquin, your parte chino. Check it out. Listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Hey, this is Patrice Rushen, and whenever I'm in the Bay Area and I need good information and great radio, it's all about Hard Knock Radio.